All right, well, then I'll go back to the supplement 8. All right, I'm not going to be able to cover this entire supplement by any means, but I will try to hit most of the highlights. And if you have specific questions that relate to any of these points, that would be helpful. So I'll just start with the topic itself. Typically, when you pick up a newspaper or turn on the 11 o'clock news or whatever, and there's discussion of inflation, the term is almost always used as a synonym for rising prices, just as deflation is typically used as a synonym for falling prices. Yet, if you have any semi-decent dictionary and you look at the definition of inflation, you'll find that there's also a different meaning given as the second or sometimes perhaps the third meaning, and that will typically be an undue increase in the quantity of money. And inflation is an undue increase in the quantity of money. And we'll see that that is a vastly superior definition. The definition of inflation as rising prices is really something that an educated person should not use. And similarly with deflation, it creates a great deal of confusion and it rests on major ignorance of the subject. And let's start with why. First off, if you define inflation as rising prices, you have a problem that it appears there can be a wide variety of different explanations. A variety of things could explain why this or that particular price rises at some time or other. You could have bad crops, they raise the prices of agricultural commodities. That could be the actions of terrorists blowing up an oil pipeline. That would certainly raise the price of oil. You could have labor unions demanding wage increases. That could certainly raise some prices. You could have a fall in the foreign exchange value of the currency. That could raise the price of imports. Sometimes you might have a businessman deciding simply to raise his price, that raises that price. So there are a variety of things that could be responsible for prices going up in this or that particular circumstance. And then the problem that you have is when you're confronted with rising prices, it appears that there's half a dozen or more possible explanations. So you have so many different possible explanations that you don't really know what the cause is in any particular case. You don't know where to look if you're thinking is inflation is rising prices, because there's a substantial variety of things that could cause rising prices in particular instances. So that's one problem. Anytime you have an understanding of something such that the thing can be produced by a multiple of causes, you really don't know what the cause is. You're ignorant of the actual cause until you would carry out a further investigation. And that's the typical status with respect to inflation. We had a long period where one administration in power after another would complain about inflation, and they think they first needed to appoint some special presidential commission to study why it was happening now. There's always one very simple explanation of inflation, what it is. It is, as I've indicated, an undue increase in the quantity of money. But I'll be validating that in detail. Now, notice further, if you think that inflation is rising prices, if that's your idea of inflation, then when does inflation come into existence? When does it come into existence if it's rising prices?
When the prices are already too high.
When prices are increased.
Yeah.
It's thought inflation exists, comes into existence in the act of raising prices. Before that instant, it didn't exist. Now prices are raised, and now inflation exists. It's thought it just springs into existence. Now, who raises prices? Do they raise themselves?
Yeah. Yeah. The economy does when the demand goes up.
Well, if you walk into any kind of store, if you're there and they have certain prices you're familiar with, then the next time you go back, you notice that many of their prices are higher. How did the prices on the shelves and in their newspaper ads, in their catalog, how did those prices get higher?
The retailer increased them based on either...
Yeah, someone, the management gave orders to the clerks, go and post these new prices, or the advertising copywriters, they were told our new price for this or that is now such and such. So if it appears on the basis that inflation is rising prices, that who's responsible for this? Who makes the prices rise?
Well, it's a kind of a cyclical thing. The retailer will change it.
Well, who's directly making the prices rise?
It could be because costs have increased.
But who are
the retailer?
It's the sellers who are making prices rise, and the costs. When the costs go up, that's other prices. So a retailer might say, okay, I'm raising my price because my wholesaler has raised his price. But who raised the wholesale price? The wholesaler. And who is raising the retail price? The retailer. So it appears that the parties responsible for inflation are businessmen. They're the ones who are raising prices. And allegedly, if they did not raise their prices, then what would be true of inflation?
Wouldn't exist.
It wouldn't exist. So it's thought businessmen are responsible for inflation. That's what's implied by the definition of inflation as rising prices. And then another implication is, this is point three, is that there's a very simple way to eliminate inflation. Pardon me?
Kill all of this?
Well, that's a more remote inference. But what would be an apparently simple, direct way, which is actually resorted to again and again?
Increasing interest rates.
Pardon me?
Increasing interest rates.
Well, are you following the supplement at all? If it's thought that inflation is rising prices and wouldn't exist if prices didn't rise, well, what's a simple, apparently simple way of stopping inflation?
Don't take price increases.
Prohibit prices from rising. Impose price controls. So if it's against the law to raise prices and the law is enforced, then prices don't rise. And supposedly what's happened to inflation?
Doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. That's what is thought to be the case. Now, this whole approach is really utterly primitive. It's comparable, in thinking that inflation is rising prices, it's comparable to thinking that a fever in a patient is a high reading, a reading above 98.6 on a thermometer. You can make an inference that a fever exists if you read above 98.6 on a thermometer. But is the fever the reading of higher than 98.6 on the thermometer? Is that the fever? Because if you think it is, then what's a very simple remedy for any fever? Put the thermometer in ice water, cool the thermometer down, and then you don't have the reading. Now, you could do that, but have you done anything to the fever inside the patient? Not at all. Similarly, you can have a pressure gauge on a boiler, and the needle in the pressure gauge is indicating the pressure in the boiler. If you thought that the pressure in the boiler was the reading on the gauge, well, then what's a simple way to reduce the pressure? Just move the needle in the gauge. Now, are you in fact reducing the fever or reducing the pressure by manipulating the outward manifestation of the fever or the pressure? No, you're not dealing with the problem at all. You're dealing with an isolated symptom, and the outcome will be you haven't done anything to the problem. In fact, as a minimum, because you haven't done anything appropriate, the problem is going to get worse. And that's true with inflation. You can have laws prohibiting prices from rising, and they can be obeyed scrupulously, but such laws don't do anything to reduce inflation. They prevent this important symptom of inflation, the rise in prices, but preventing that symptom doesn't stop the underlying phenomenon. The underlying phenomenon, as I'll be at great pains to elaborate, is the undue increase in the quantity of money. And what is that increase in the quantity of money doing to the demand for practically everything in the economic system? If you think back to your studies in another course of demand curves, demand schedules, what does an increase in the quantity of money do to the various demand curves in the economic system? It raises all the demand curves. Now that means that at any given set of prices, people are prepared to buy larger quantities. It's their preparedness to buy larger quantities at any given set of prices that operates to raise prices. If prices are prohibited from rising, what still happens? Well, I'm saying that prices are prohibited from rising.
Oh, prohibited.
They're prohibited from rising, but people have new and additional money that they would like to spend. They would like to buy larger quantities of things, but the prices are not allowed to rise. So what happens to quantities demanded throughout the economic system?
Why don't they exceed the quantities produced?
The quantities demanded quickly come to exceed the quantities produced, and when that happens, what do you have?
Shortage.
You have shortages. So, pardon me?
At higher prices?
No, if the prices are not allowed to rise, if that's against the law, then what happens is the increase in the quantity of money combines with the price controls. We still have the inflation, only now the inflation can't manifest itself in higher prices. It instead combines with the controlled prices and results in shortages. So we still have inflation, but it just takes it has a different major outcome, shortages instead of higher prices. Now, if the inflation had been allowed to raise prices, why would that have prevented shortages?
So it would have leveled out the supply curve versus the demand curve.
Well, when prices go up, what does that do to quantities demanded compared to the quantities demanded are held down? So people would like to buy more at the same set of prices, but if prices go up, they will tend not to buy so much more. They won't buy more than is available. Prices will be high enough to make them limit their purchases to what's available so you don't have shortages. But if you have price controls, you still have inflation, it just results in shortages. Now, going further, and this is the next point, the definition of inflation as rising prices can actually lead to the further expansion in the quantity of money in a misguided effort to keep prices from rising. How could that happen? Well, if you think inflation is rising prices and you want to restrain prices from rising, there's another way to do that besides price controls. Suppose the government were to approach the sellers of some key goods whose price it didn't want to rise, and these sellers can tell the government, well, look, our costs are going up, but we need to raise prices to cover our higher costs. What could the government possibly do that would enable these sellers to cover their higher costs and yet not raise prices? Give them subsidies. The government could provide subsidies. Okay, but what is a possible source of the government getting money to pay the subsidies? They could print the additional money. One possible source is they could print additional money. And so there you have the government actually creating still more money in an effort to control, to hold down prices. Now, where this can very readily come up, there are many people who regard the rate of interest as a price, and when interest rates rise, what is the immediate effect of that on the prices of goods that are sensitive to interest rates?
Increase.
It will raise them, and what happens to the cost to mortgage payments if mortgage rates go up?
Increase.
Mortgage payments would rise. Car payments would be higher at higher interest rates. So there are people who think, well, this is part of inflation. A rise in interest rates is part of inflation. And they especially think the government should be concerned with keeping interest rates down. And if they think that keeping interest rates down is a means of holding back inflation, well, what's the government's foremost means of keeping interest rates down? What does the Federal Reserve do to hold down interest rates? Yes?
Open market operation.
Well, what are they doing in the open market operation?
They buy and sell the bonds.
Well, what are they doing when they want to use the open market operation to reduce interest rates?
Bonds.
Pardon me?
They're selling bonds.
They want to reduce interest rates.
Yeah, they're
bonds. When a reduction in interest rates implies what happening to the prices of bonds? They would go up. And raising bond prices reduces yields, and that's brought about by the Federal Reserve entering the market and buying government securities. And where does the Federal Reserve get the money with which to buy government securities?
From the Treasury Department.
From the printing.
It doesn't get it from the Treasury Department.
They make it up.
They create the money. The Treasury gets money from the Federal Reserve. The Treasury gets money from the Federal Reserve, which the Federal Reserve brings into existence virtually by printing it, or not even printing it, just through having some computer entries. So here you actually have an effort to halt or diminish inflation by diminishing the rise in interest rates, and doing that by creating money more rapidly, which has the effect, of course, of raising prices that much further, or worsening shortages if you have price controls. All right, well, in contrast to this, we have an alternative definition of inflation, which provisionally you can take as an undue increase in the quantity of money. Now, this is the actual factor, and I'll be at pains to show it's the only thing that can explain an inflationary rise in prices. It's the only thing that can explain the cluster of symptoms that people associate with inflation. The only thing that can explain the full cluster of symptoms that people associate with inflation is an increase in the quantity of money. Now, how can we show this? Well, first, however many possible causes there might be, however many factors there might be that could contribute to prices rising, there are only two direct possible causes of higher prices. There are only two possible direct causes of higher prices, looked at from a mathematical point of view. And this is what I am referring to in point one under B, the demand-supply test, using the formula for the general consumer price level. Now, this is the formula that we started back in chapter 12 with. The general consumer price level, understood as the weighted average of the prices at which goods are actually sold, the weighted average of prices at which goods are actually sold, is equal to the amount of money spent to buy goods divided by the supply of goods sold. The actual consumer price level, the average of prices at which goods are actually sold, is the amount of money spent to buy them divided by the quantity sold. And we can start with the simplest type of case. The bookstore down on the second floor sells these bottles of water. Suppose your assignment was find out the average price at which such a bottle of water was sold there over the last week. What information would you need to obtain?
Last
Number of bottles sold.
All right, the number of bottles sold, that would be one element.
Prices at which they were sold.
And here's the number of bottles sold. That would fit under S sub C. And what's the item? What would you need to get for the demand for these bottles? The amount of money that the buyers spent in buying these bottles. So if, for example, over the last week, buyers spent $100 and they bought 100 bottles, then we would know that the average price at which a bottle of water such as this was sold was exactly $1. And we could do the same thing for any other good in that bookstore. We could do the same thing for any good in any store in South Coast Plaza, any other store in Orange County. The average price at which anything is sold over any period of time is the amount of money spent to buy it divided by the quantity sold. That's the average price at which the good is actually sold. Now, we do the same thing for all goods taken together. We have to compile the total amount of money in the whole economic system spent to buy consumers' goods. There is some definite total. It's close to $10 trillion. And we would have to express the total supply of goods in some way. That's not a very easy thing to do, but it is doable. We can, in one way or another, add up the houses, automobiles, television sets, computers, hairdos, whatever, all of the consumer goods and services. And it represents some kind of total. Whatever it is, it is. And now, if you conceive it that way, if you conceive of the average at which prices, the average of the prices at which goods are actually sold is the reflection of an amount of money spent to buy them divided by the quantity of them sold, then from a purely mathematical point of view, what is necessary for the price level to be higher? What do we know must happen if the price level is in fact to be higher? If in fact the supply of goods actually sold has a higher price this year than last year, yes, Mr. Drew, what has to be true?
Well, either the demand increase or the supply.
Exactly. Either the demand has to be greater, the numerator has to be larger, or the denominator has to be smaller. Take the bottles of water as an example. If we know this last week 100 bottles were sold for $100, and that gave us an average price of $1 a bottle, if next week the average price were to be $2 a bottle, what would have to be true?
Demand would have had to 200 bottles.
Okay. One possibility would be $200 would be spent to buy 100 bottles. Another possibility would be only 50 bottles were sold for $100, or some intermediate combination. There would have to be a rise in the spending and or fall in the amount sold. Now, would it be possible for the average price at which anything is sold to be higher if there were no more spending to buy it and no lesser supply sold? If the spending to buy something were the same and the quantity sold were the same, would it be possible for the average price at which the thing was sold to be any different? It could not possibly be. The only way conceivable that the average price at which goods are sold can be higher is if there is more spending to buy those goods or there are fewer goods being sold, or a combination of the two. Anything else is literally unthinkable. You simply could not imagine prices being higher without more money being spent to buy goods or a smaller quantity of goods being sold. It is literally unthinkable. Unthinkable in the full sense of the term. No more thinkable than you could think of a square circle. Well, this means that we have a simple elementary test in determining whether or not something might be a cause of higher prices. If anything is in fact to be a cause of higher prices, what must we be able to connect it with? If anything other than more demand or less supply is to be a cause of higher prices, what must it be connectable to. Like I've been saying, the increase in the quantity of money is responsible for higher prices. Well, how does the increase in the quantity of money connect with these critical elements?
Well, if you have an increase in the quantity of money and the demand is still there and the prices have not increased, it will create an inflationary through shortage.
Well, what does the increase in the quantity of, which of these two does the increase in the quantity of money operate on?
On the demand side.
On the demand. The increase in the quantity of money. See, what determines demand? What determines spending?
How much money?
And the quantity of money. The amount of money spent is determined by the amount of money that exists. That's the essential proposition of the quantity theory of money. So when we say that prices rise because of more of an increase in the quantity of money, the connecting mechanism is the increase in spending, the increase in demand. The increase in the quantity of money connects with higher prices by way of increasing the aggregate demand. Now, any other factor that is going to be operative to raise prices, anything other than more demand or less supply themselves, has to be something that causes more demand or less supply. And if there is something that we can't relate to causing more demand or less supply, if we say, well, something is a cause of higher prices, but we cannot show how it raises demand or lowers supply, then in fact we have no basis for thinking that it is a cause of higher prices. There's no way to connect it. It would have no means, just no connection with the phenomenon. So here we are, we have these two essential elements, and we know that in order for prices to rise, there must be either more demand or less supply. And the only valid possible further causes of higher prices are causes that contribute to more demand or less supply. And if they don't, they're just not causes. All right, so first off, we've reduced the possible number of causes, the number of direct causes of higher prices, to just two. There's only two possible direct causes, more demand or less supply. And now what we want to do is eliminate less supply. I'm going to give you a variety of reasons to show why the whole problem of rising prices resides on the side of more demand, not less supply. And the first point is that over the period of years in which we've had rising prices as a problem, what has actually happened to supply? Let's start with the United States.
Increase.
The supply has increased. How long have we had a problem of rising prices?
Since the 70s.
Well, it's certainly been since 70. It didn't start in 70.
Since the beginning of the United States.
No, that's not true.
Why?
Since 1933. Over the 19th century, from 1800 to 1900, prices actually fell. Prices in 1900 were on the order of half of what they had been in 1800. We had two whole generations of falling prices. In the generation from 1823 to 1848, prices were falling. Then the fall was stopped because of the discovery of the California gold fields, and then prices were falling again from 1873 to 1896, and that was the year of major gold discoveries in Australia, Alaska, and South Africa. But over those two earlier generations, prices fell quite significantly, to the extent that over the century as a whole, prices were half at the end compared to what they had been at the beginning. Now, our problem of chronically rising prices really goes back just to 1933. But what has been happening to the production and supply of goods, at least in the United States, in practically every year since 1933?
It's increased.
So, in reality, supply has been going up, And as far as that has been the case, what's been the contribution of supply to the price level, at least in comparison with what the price level would otherwise have been?
What is the relationship?
Supply has been going up, and so what has been the contribution of supply to the price level, at least in comparison with what the price level would otherwise have been?
Decrease?
The effect of supply has been to reduce the price level compared to what it would otherwise have been. Now, I don't know the precise multiple by which supply has increased since 1933, but I don't think we'd be too far off if we made an estimate of 25 times. Now, just imagine if we had had the same aggregate demand. Suppose this numerator had been unchanged since 1933. Whatever it was in 1933, we assume it would still be that today. And supply has increased by a factor of 25. So we're multiplying by 25 in the denominator. What would be implied about prices in order for the same volume of spending to buy 25 times more goods? How much would it come down? What would it be? Pardon me? 25%? Any other estimates?
For 50%.
I'm sorry?
4/3.
Well, if we had the same spending and it buys 25 times as much, what would have had to happen to prices?
Same spending is buying 25 times as much.
Yeah.
We had to reduce.
You'd have
prices.
To reduce prices. So here we are.
At least 25 times.
At least what?
At least 25.
We have the demand, it's you can always write one here. It's one, demand is one, it's unchanged. The supply is 25 times. So prices would be 1 over 25. That's not 25%, that's 1/25, which is 4%. Prices would have fallen 96% as far as supply goes. That's the contribution of supply. Now, what has actually happened to prices over this interval? Well, they've increased enormously. Again, I can't tell you precisely how much, but I would estimate roughly at least on the order of 25 times. So if it's the case that prices are 25 times higher at the same time that supply is 25 times greater, what's implied about demand? What kind of demand do you need such that when you divide it by 25, you get 25? Pardon me?
25.
The demand, if the demand rose 25 times and the supply rose 25 times, what kind of prices would we have? They'd be unchanged. In order for prices to rise 25 times, the demand has to rise 25 times 25 times, which is 625 times. So what's responsible for this rise in prices is not at all less supply. The contribution of supply, the supply has been enormously increased. As far as it goes, it's been working to reduce prices. But the effect of more demand has been so powerful that it swamped the price-reducing effect of more supply on the order of 625 to 25. We've had, in effect, on the order of a 625-fold increase in demand versus a 25-fold increase in supply. It's the increase in demand which has been responsible for the rise in prices, despite in opposition to the increase in supply. So this is point B. Even where supply is, well, it's not point B. It's an elaboration of A. But now we can turn to B. There have been some places in the world in which over a period, perhaps as long as a decade, a supply has fallen rather than risen. The most recent significant example possibly was in Russia in the 1990s. They had a lot of additional chaos there. Again, I can't give you a precise estimate of how much supply fell, but even if we put it very high at 50%, suppose you have a country where the total supply of goods over some period of time falls in half. All right, how much of a rise in prices could that produce?
Twice.
It could serve to double prices. But what was happening to prices in Russia over the years in which the supply was falling?
Price control.
I'm asking what was happening to prices in the years in which supply was falling. Well, they rose quite dramatically. They rose by substantially more than a factor of two. And so what do you, to that extent, what do you have to attribute the rise in prices to?
The quantity of money increased.
The increase in money and spending. Now, there were other cases back earlier in the latter part of the last century in Chile under Allende and in the regime preceding Allende, and also in Uruguay. They had some very serious problems and throughout the 1960s, early 70s, and it's possible over that period their aggregate supply as a maximum might have fallen in half. But what was happening to prices in those Latin American countries, in virtually all the Latin American countries, practically every year? They're going up, what, 2%, 3%? In the high double digits, and sometimes the triple digits. Well, if prices are rising 50, 80, 100% a year, what does that do to prices over the course of a decade? It increases them enormously. If you had prices doubling every year for 10 years, well, that's 2 to the 10th power. So that would be pretty huge. The fall in supply could at most account for prices doubling when in fact over the same period of time prices increased in radically greater degree. Now, to be more precise, to go into a more exact approach, I make the point in C that reductions in supply would only be able to explain a sustained significant rise in prices. The only way they could explain such a sustained significant rise in prices would be if material civilization were in the process of rapidly disappearing. We would really need material civilization to be disappearing almost before our eyes in order to explain any kind of sustained significant rise in prices based on falling supply. Now, what would you call a relatively modest annual rise in prices? What's considered a modest rise in prices today in our country?
3 to 5%.
Pardon me?
3 to 5%.
Well, I'm talking about as an overall economy-wide average. I would think on the order of 2%. 2% would be relatively modest. Let's work with 2%. Now, imagine that prices were rising at a 2% compound annual rate, a rate considered relatively modest. All right, if prices were rising year in and year out on the order of 2% a year, how long would it take for prices to double?
50 years?
Well, on the order, the rule of 72, that's the rule that if you want to know how long it takes a sum to double at a given percentage compound rate, you divide the percentage into 72. So if we're saying a 2% compound annual rate, if you divide that into 72, it's 36 years. I think the more precise number is actually about 35 years, but either way. All right, let's say that if prices rise 2% a year, year in and year out, in 35 years, prices will double. All right, what is implied as to how much supply would have to fall if in each of these 35 years, what's causing the 2% rise in prices is a corresponding reduction in supply? how much would supply have had to fall over 35 years if that's the period in which it produces a doubling of prices?
2%.
I'm sorry?
2%.
The cumulative fall in supply over 35 years. Yes?
50%.
50%. Supply would have to be halved. If it's going to double prices, to find a doubling of prices due to a fall in supply, there has to be a halving of supply. And if supply were falling in the ratio of 1 over 1.02, if supply were always 1 over 1.02 this year compared to last year, but 1 over 1.02 to the 35th power should be about 50%, should be about a half. All right, well, that means in 35 years, the economy would be half as large as it was when we started. And now, if we wanted to explain prices rising at 2% a year, not just for 35 years, but for 70 years, where would the economy be at the end of 70 years? In terms of its physical size.
One-fourth.
It would have a second time. And what about 105 years?
One-fifth.
Pardon me?
One-fifth.
Well, we're going from a half to a fourth, and now
an eighth.
It would be a half to the third power. This is happening three times. That would be an eighth. So that would mean in a little over a century, in order to explain prices rising at just 2% a year for that period of time, the only way that that would be explainable on the basis of less supply would be if there had been a 7/8 cumulative reduction in supply. Now, I don't think the Roman Empire fell that rapidly. So in order to explain a 2% annual rise in prices for a prolonged period of time, such as a century, on the basis of falling supply, you'd really need the economy disintegrating. Now, that's just a 2% rise in prices. What if we talk about a more serious rise, like 5%? How long does it take for prices to double at a 5% compound annual increase? 14 years. Okay. That would mean that in order for less supply to explain doubling of prices at a 5% compound annual rate of increase, supply would have to be halved in just 14 years. And that would mean supply would be quartered in 28 years. And in 56 years, it would be reduced to 1/16. And in 112 years, it would be reduced to a 16th of a 16th. It would be 1/256th of its original size. And if you want to explain a 10% annual rise in prices, it gets that much worse. So the point is that it is really not possible to explain really at all any serious rise in prices. No way to explain, let's say, a 10% or higher rise in prices based on falling supply. The economy would literally disappear within a decade or two. Now, so I think this is a very serious consideration, limiting the potential of lower supply as a source of higher prices. If you don't see material civilization disappearing, then it certainly can't be falling supply which is underlying the rise in prices. And then further, and this is point D, where you do have a decrease in supply, as existed in Uruguay and Chile, the decrease in supply is itself very often a result of rapid increases in money and spending. What makes supply decrease is some of the consequences of rapid increases in money and spending. Now, how would that work? Well, imagine we have the quantity of money and volume of spending growing very rapidly, and prices are rising let's say 30, 40, 50% a year, what would that be doing to many people? What would happen to you if your pay, let's say, were adjusted annually, and over that year, prices have risen 30 or 40%?
I'd buy less.
Well, you'd buy an awful lot less, and what would be the effect on whoever was in this position? They'd be greatly impoverished by this, and when you have such a result occurring to a large percentage of the population, what kind of environment do you think that results in? What kind of social, political environment? There'll be a great deal of unrest, hostility. It'll be the kind of thing where you have civil strife, work stoppages, and this is one indication of how production itself then gets cut in response as a byproduct of the terrible results of the rapid increases in money and spending. Yes?
Plus, there wouldn't be any saving at all, because you would buy everything as soon as you could, right?
Yeah, and that's a further very major effect.
So I have a question about, all this time we're talking about this, are we just assuming that the population is stable, that we're not increasing the number of people on the earth?
Well, we could assume that we're increasing the number of people, yeah. And that's part of, we've had a huge increase in the U.S. since 1933. I think our population has gone from maybe 120 million thereabouts in 1933.
Doesn't that justify some increase in the money supply?
Well, you might, that's one question if you're asking, does it justify? But certainly, if we had that increase and we didn't have an increase in the money supply, the increase in population would be a cause of a larger supply of goods. That's one of the causes of the larger supply of goods. More people are working and producing. And so as far as it goes, what's the effect on prices?
Well, they're less, but see, I don't get that logic, because I would think that if the same dollars are there and more people are buying for them, then they would be getting less dollars to spread around, because more people have them in their hands.
All right, now, if we want to think through the implications all the way of there being an unchanged quantity of money, an unchanged volume of spending, that would imply the demand for labor would be unchanged, total payrolls would be unchanged, and then as we would have more and more people entering the labor force because there's a growing population, what would be the effect of that on money wage rates? They would go down, and so the wage per worker would be less. But what's the effect of more people working on the supply of goods produced?
Should be more.
There'd be more. And then at the same time, what's happening to the output per worker? As we have scientific and technological progress and capital accumulation.
More.
So as supply goes, this is reinforcing the fact that as far as supply is concerned, its effect is to lower prices. And as far as a larger supply of labor is concerned, it would be operating by itself to lower wage rates. Now, if we observe that instead wage rates and prices are higher and rapidly rising, what has to be the explanation? More demand, which rests on a foundation of more money.
But don't you think that due to the resistance of businessmen to lower their prices, because I think that there is some resistance there, you don't want to make that change because it's difficult to go back up, then that resistance is going to have this delay.
Well, you're raising a different question about the ease or difficulty with which prices might be lowered. But my point here is simply to point out that the only thing that's responsible for rising prices is not less supply, but more demand. Now, you might say, okay, isn't to some extent more demand necessary? Isn't it desirable? But that's a different point. Okay. Now, to go further, I think when people complain about an inflationary rise in prices, they actually mean something more than a rise in the strict weighted average of prices. If, for example, 51% of prices rose and 49% of prices fell, both to the same degree, there would be some rise in the weighted average of prices. But I think if we had such a huge number of prices falling, almost as many prices falling as had risen, I don't think people would say, well, this is a problem of inflation. I think when people complain about inflation, they have in mind more than just a rise in the weighted average of prices. They also have a further idea about the range of prices rising. The number of prices rising far exceeds the number falling. Now, if we incorporate that as another requirement, that there has to be not only a rise in the weighted average of prices, but also at the same time, the number of prices rising has to far outweigh the number falling, I don't think you could get that on the basis of less supply. Because let's consider what is the effect of less supply of any kind of necessity or any kind of important complementary good.
Increase the price.
Oh, now the price will increase, the price of that good will increase, but if it's a necessity, will the rise in price be simply in inverse proportion to the decrease in supply? So if, for example, the price of oil, if the supply of oil were to fall 5%, would the price of oil rise 5%? Imagine some lunatics in Saudi Arabia blow up an oil pipeline, and the effect is to reduce the global supply of oil by 5%. Now, here we are, there's 5% less oil available for some time, and that means that people are going to have to use 5% less oil. What kind of prices of oil products would be required so that people would say, I just can't afford this much oil anymore, I'm cutting my consumption 5%. What would it take to make you reduce your gasoline consumption 5%?
Stop driving or
a very large rise, a disproportionate rise. This is the demand for something like oil or any other necessity is inelastic. We have an inelastic demand. That means that in order to reduce the quantity demanded by a given percentage, you need a much greater percentage increase in the price. The price has to rise disproportionately to the reduction in quantity demanded in order to achieve that reduction in quantity demanded. So if it were the case that to get people to cut their consumption of oil products by 5%, imagine for the sake of illustration, the price of oil products needed to double. I don't think they would actually need to double, but there would have to be something substantial. But if it were a doubling, what would be implied about how much money people would be spending to buy the 5% smaller supply of oil?
Well,
if you had to pay, if you had to pay twice the price to buy 0.95 the supply, what is 2 times 0.95?
One point nine.
Two times 0.9 is 1.8. 2 times 0.95 is 1.9. So now, if people were spending 1.9 times as much as they used to be spending to buy oil, if we didn't have an increase in the quantity of money and the overall ability to spend, if overall total spending in the economy still had to be the same, but people are spending 90% more in buying oil, what would that imply about the money they had left to buy things other than oil? That would be significantly less. And that's incidentally a reason why when news comes across the ticker tape during stock market hours that something is going on raising the price of oil, what effect does that typically have on the price of common stocks? They will go down, and what's making it go down is some kind of realization that the higher price of oil will draw funds away from the purchase of many other things, so that there'll be lower sales revenues throughout much of the rest of the economy, with a depressing effect on earnings elsewhere in the economy. So the disproportionate rise in price of any necessity due to a reduction in its supply operates to draw spending away, to depress spending on other things. Because people are financing the surge in spending for the good in reduced supply, the necessity in reduced supply, they're getting the money to pay the sharply higher price by spending less on other things. Well, as far as that goes, what should be the effect on the prices of those other things, at least, again, compared with what they would otherwise be? They should be less. What you'd expect to be the effect of a surge in the price of oil on the demand for and price of new automobiles?
The price should decrease.
They should go down. And the price of motel rooms? They should go down. And any other things related to having to spend more for oil. Now also, you know, many people think, well, oil is a price, the price of oil in one form or another enters into the cost of producing so many things. And that's true. It may be that the production of almost everything directly or indirectly depends on oil and the price of oil. But notice, if there's less oil available, how does that affect the utility of things like iron and copper, lead, lumber, and labor? If there's less oil, what is the effect of that on the usefulness and effectiveness of other factors of production?
Less wood increase the price.
Well, let's say here you are. We use iron and steel to produce automobiles, but if we don't have sufficient oil to provide the gasoline to run all that many cars, and what does that do to our need for things like iron and steel?
It decreases
it. And so what should be the effect on the prices of these complementary means of production? That should be under pressure to fall. So that it isn't the case at all that the rise in the price of oil means anything like a commensurate rise in cost of production throughout the economy. It raises costs as far as the price of oil goes, but at the same time, factors are present working to reduce elements of other costs, like as far as the price of iron or copper or lead or zinc or lumber enters into costs. The rise in the price of oil is working to reduce those components.
I mean, it doesn't really reduce the pricing of it, but because there's an overabundance of supply of materials, because the demand is down, the other businesses are forced to reduce their profit margins in order to stimulate sales.
Well,
they may own those other materials at a lower cost, right?
The price of those other materials will come down.
Right.
And you can see that on the commodity exchanges. If all that we have is a lesser supply of oil driving up the price of oil, that development works to reduce other commodity prices. Now, there can be some modest rise in overall costs, but not anywhere commensurate with the rise in the price of oil, and the demand for many products will be less, and those prices will be under pressure to decline. And the same would be true if we had a lesser supply of wheat, let's say, that has an inelastic demand. People would spend more money buying wheat products if there's a lesser supply than with a greater supply. But where would the money come from?
From what they were spending.
At the expense of other goods. So when you have a lesser supply of any kind of necessity or any kind of complementary good, its effect is to reduce the demand for a substantial variety of other goods and to put downward pressure on their prices. Now, if you see that while there's less of a supply of oil, that nevertheless, at the same time, almost everything else is rising in price rather than anything falling, what has to explain that?
That you had a drop in supply of the oil.
Well, we know that, I'm saying there is a drop in supply of oil. Now, if we only had a drop in supply of oil and there were no change on the side of money and overall total spending, the drop in the supply of oil should pull spending away from many things and cause their prices to fall somewhat. But if we don't see that, if we see at the same time the prices of virtually everything are still rising, not everything is rising as rapidly as oil, but everything is rising to some degree, what has to be present to explain this? The increase in money and spending. You see, if you have more money and spending, that's something that is capable of operating on everything at the same time. If you have more money, there can be more spending for everything at the same time. If there's less supply, it's going to shake up the demand. It's going to pull funds away from some areas, putting some areas under pressure to fall. There's yet a further consideration, which is perhaps even more important, and this is point F. That decreases in supply do not produce the effects on the relations between debtors and creditors, or between stockholders and bondholders, that people associate with inflation. And we need to realize here that when people complain of inflation, not only are they thinking that there's a rise in the average of prices, there's a rise in the broad range of prices, there is a further significant symptom too, which needs to be made explicit, and that is the association with debtors gaining at the expense of creditors, of stockholders gaining at the expense of bondholders. And this is properly very closely associated with inflation. Just think, you may be planning for your future, or perhaps soon will be. You may be planning for how you're going to live in 30 years. All right, what sort of investment do you think you should be making? Do you think you should be accumulating blue chip bonds? Why not?
Yeah. Inflation. There's going to be more money in the system.
Yeah.
So $50,000 today won't be as worth.
Okay.
So
whatever you would put into these bonds today, by the time you get it out, even with the interest you'd earn, you'd have to expect that the buying power will be substantially less than it is today, and you may very well lose by having done that. So what sort of investment would you be more likely to consider? Common stocks. Common stocks are obviously a much better long-term investment than bonds in an era of inflation. Because what can you expect to be happening to the price of stocks, especially over a long period of time?
Rising.
They should be rising. The corporations that are issuing the stocks, we should expect that they'll be in a position to increase their profits as the years go by. And it's the stockholders who enjoy the benefit of the additional profits. But the bonds, if you buy a long-term bond at some contractually fixed interest rate, if you bought, let's say, a 6% bond, well, it's 6% now and for the next 30 years. And it doesn't matter what else is going on, you're limited to that 6%. All right, so it's very well known that in an era of inflation, it is vastly better to be a stockholder rather than a bondholder, and to be a debtor rather than a creditor. Just think, if you go into debt, let's say, to take out a mortgage to buy a home, why does that normally appear to be a good idea?
Because what going to go up.
Yes?
Because the prices are going to go up.
So you expect the price of the home to be rising as the years go by. And your debt is contractually fixed. So you borrow a certain sum, and it might be substantial at the time you borrowed it. But if we have significant inflation, you should expect to be able to earn more and more money as the years pass. The price of your house should be rising as the years pass. I know I can confirm this in my own experience. When my wife and I moved to California, we bought a house that I think we paid $124,000 for, something like that. and maybe a little bit more. We had a mortgage maybe for roughly $100,000, which I thought was huge at the time. And now, today, $100,000 or $125,000 for a house is unheard of. I don't think you can get a good dog house for that money. And that kind of mortgage is really not, that would be an extremely small mortgage. So it was a very good idea to take it out. We paid it off. We gained through the inflationary rise in the price of our house. But what about the people who lent us the $100,000? They lent it when the buying power of $100,000 was quite substantial, and they got it repaid over the next 25 years or so as the buying power of money steadily depreciated. So they lost. The borrower gained, the creditor lost. The stockholders gain, the bondholders lose. Now, most people associate this simply with the rise in prices, but it really takes more than just a rise in prices. It requires that the rise in prices proceed from the side of money and spending, not from the side of reduced production and supply. And let's just see why this is the case. And we'll look at it in terms of a series of balance sheets. Here we are. We have the initial balance sheet of a hypothetical average firm before there's a rise in prices from any cause. This is before prices rise, either from more demand or less supply. And we're assuming that the assets of our hypothetical firm are initially $2 million. And this represents a given quantity of plant, equipment, and inventories at a given level of prices, and capable of producing a given physical volume of output at a corresponding level of prices. So that's our initial situation. And we assume the capitalization of this firm is $1 million of debt to bondholders and other creditors, and there's $1 million of net worth for stockholders. So on the liability side, we have $2 million, matching the $2 million on the asset side. We assume half the capital came from bondholders and half came from stockholders. And now we're going to look at the next situation. And this will be, there's going to be a rise in prices. And this particular rise is going to be the result of a reduction in production and supply. So here we are. This is the balance sheet of a hypothetical average firm following a rise in prices caused by a halving of supply. We're assuming the quantity of money, the volume of spending in the economy, that's unchanged. What's gone on is that something has brought about a halving of production and supply, and a halving of the physical assets of firms. So our typical firm is still going to be worth $2 million, but this $2 million will represent half of the initial quantity of plant, equipment, and inventories, at double the initial level of prices. And it's only capable of producing half the physical volume of output at a doubled price level. Well, here we are. The bondholders still have their million. Now, if you're a bondholder, what's your position? And what kind of prices do you have to pay as a consumer? You have to pay double the prices, right? So you've lost half the value of your investment. But what's your position as a stockholder? You still are only worth $1 million. There's nothing increasing the total monetary value of assets. We have less assets at higher prices. There are as many fewer assets as there are higher prices. If it's less supply, that's responsible. So what are the stockholders worth? Have they gained any special monetary value here? No, they're only worth $1 million still. And so what's happened to the buying power of their investment? They're in no better position than the bondholders. If you have a reduction in production and supply that's raising prices, well, anyone whose monetary net worth is unchanged is going to suffer. But there is nothing here to raise the monetary net worth of stockholders as a class. In fact, we can easily think of a situation in which, as bad as it is to be a bondholder, it could be even worse to be a stockholder. Let's suppose that what produces this outcome would be a series of massive bombing raids or widespread terrorist attacks. And imagine that instead of wiping out half the firms completely, imagine that it wiped out half of all of the different firms. Suppose we had the different firms losing, on average, half their assets. All right, who takes the loss first as between stockholders and bondholders? Suppose half of the assets of a firm are wiped out. Okay, it's the stockholders. If we had a situation where half these assets were wiped out, the initial effect would be the value of the assets would have to be written down from 2 million to 1 million. And whose million would be wiped out on the liability side? The stockholders. Okay, if we have half the physical assets, that means we can only produce half, so price is double. The bondholders are certainly hurting. They have still only their 1 million, and they're paying double the prices of consumers' goods. But what's the situation of a stockholder? He has to pay double the prices too, and he has no capital. So he's actually worse off. Well, when is it that the stockholders will actually gain in connection with rising prices? Well, it's in the next situation over here. Now here we have a doubling of prices resulting from twice the money in spending. Well, what will twice the money in spending be doing to the monetary value of the assets of the average firm? It should double it. We have the same physical assets at twice the prices on average. Now, so there's now 4 million of assets rather than 2 million. To whose benefit does this gain of 2 million accrue? To the stockholders. The bondholders still have just their million. Prices are doubled. The bondholders have to pay the doubled prices. The buying power of their capitals is halved. But what is the increase in money and spending done to the nominal capital of the stockholders?
Increase the value.
It's greatly increased it. In this example, it's tripled it. So the stockholders are now worth 3 million, while the bondholders are still worth 1 million. The stockholders have to pay double the prices too, but they have three times the capital with which to do that. So their buying power is actually 50% greater, while the bondholders' buying power is 50% less. So this is the scenario in which the stockholders gain at the expense of the bondholders, in which debtors gain at the expense of creditors. But what's necessary to produce that is the increase in money and spending. That's what's raising the total nominal value of the assets, which gain accrues to the benefit of the stockholders and debtors. See, if we want to explain how it is that stockholders and debtors are able to gain at the expense of bondholders and creditors, it's not simply because prices rise. If prices rose because of less supply, this gain would not be present. The only thing that allows this gain to be present is that there's an increase in money and spending, and the rise in nominal values that results in accrues to the pockets of the stockholders and debtors, not bondholders and creditors. So if we incorporate that as part of our understanding of inflation, if we're thinking of inflation as more than one symptom, if we're thinking of it not just as a strict rise in the weighted average of prices, but also building in another symptom, a rise in the broad range of prices, and even more importantly, a rise in, again, of stockholders and debtors at the expense of bondholders and creditors, if we're making that part of the symptomology too, then you can't explain that on the basis of less supply. It has to be more demand. So this brings us to point four, that the problem of inflation, understood as I've elaborated it, is exclusively one of rising aggregate demand. The whole problem of inflation is exclusively one of rising aggregate demand. And what underlies the rise in aggregate demand? The increase in the quantity of money. The increase in the quantity of money. And I ask you to recall examples from Chapter 12, and also the discussion in Chapter 12 explaining how an increase in the quantity of money, a more rapid increase, operates to raise the velocity of circulation by reducing the demand for money for holding. So that's really the only legitimate explanation of the problem of inflation, the expansion in the quantity of money. And if we press a little bit more deeply, we come to point six, which is governmental responsibility for inflation. Since 1933, who has had total control over the quantity of money? The government has. And it's used that control to persistently expand the quantity of money at a significant rate. Now, under the heading governmental responsibility for inflation, I refer first of all to the forced abandonment of gold and the creation of fiat standard money through the open market operation. Now, the original money of the country, the original, the choice of the market for money is gold. And it was overthrown by a series of deliberate acts of government policy, culminating in the open abandonment of the domestic gold standard in 1933. Now, if the gold standard had not been abandoned, if the quantity of money still had been more or less tightly limited by the increase in the supply of gold, we would have had a much, much smaller increase in the quantity of money. There would have been some, but not nearly as much as there has been. And so there could not possibly have been anything near the rise in aggregate demand that there has been. And so what would have been the effect on prices? Would it have been possible for prices to rise to anywhere near the extent they have if the growth in the quantity of money had been limited to the rate of growth in the supply of gold?
No.
So to whatever extent prices have risen more than corresponds to what they might have risen with gold, that is clearly the result of government intervention. Now, in fact, apart from periods of great new gold discoveries, the supply of gold would almost always increase somewhat less than the increase in the supply of ordinary goods and services, which would mean that there would be some tendency for prices actually to fall. And this allows us perhaps to refine the definition of inflation from undue increase in the quantity of money. We could offer a more precise definition, which would indicate where undue begins and ends. We would say that inflation is an increase in the quantity of money at a rate more rapid than the increase in the supply of gold. Inflation is an increase in the quantity of money at a rate more rapid than the increase in the supply of gold. Or equivalently, an increase in the quantity of money caused by the government. Because to the extent that we have the quantity of money increased more rapidly than the supply of gold, that's the result of government intervention. Now, from all this, there follows implicitly a solution for inflation. This is a problem that need not exist. It would not exist if the ability to create money were taken out of the government's hands. If the monetary unit were something the government could not create, if the government could not enlarge the quantity of money, well, then we simply wouldn't have any problem of inflation. If the monetary unit were some definite amount of gold, there'd be no inflation. Let me pause here and see if you have any comments, questions, objections.
going to your last statement, if government cannot continually increase the quantity of money, there would be no inflation.
Right, and they couldn't increase it beyond the increase in the supply of gold, then we wouldn't have a problem with inflation. Now, I refer here to alternative explanations of rising prices. The quantity theory of money is held by many economists, but I doubt if it's necessarily held by a majority. It's at best perhaps a substantial minority. And other explanations are put forward. And one major cluster comes under the heading the cost push doctrines. And the this comes in at least three different varieties, maybe even four. I refer to variants of the cost push doctrine, wage push. That says the problem is labor unions are driving up wage rates. That raises costs of production. The rise in costs is passed forward to the consumers as higher prices, but what's responsible is the unions jacking up wage rates. That's one category. Then closely related to that is something you can call the profit push doctrine. This doctrine says the problem is that greedy businessmen are just arbitrarily jacking up their selling prices, and to the extent that their selling prices constitute other people's costs of production, well, that's another form of cost push. Of course, sometimes they're dealing directly with consumers, but it's still put under the umbrella of cost push. And then we have a variant called crisis push, and this would refer to any kind of decrease in the supply of some vital commodity, such as oil. There are many, many people blaming the rising prices of the 70s on the oil crisis, and there's a little bit of that coming back today, where people are blaming our renewal of inflation, or fears of renewal, on the higher price of oil. I think we've already dealt with that aspect by showing that as far as a rise in the price of a particular good in reduced supply, that by itself would operate to cause other prices actually to fall, not rise. So there's a confusion in cases like this where people are thinking something that can explain a dramatic rise in the price of one or a few goods, they think that it explains a rise in prices across the whole economy when its actual effect would be to reduce many other prices. And then they also think that this one crisis can then go on rippling through the economy year after year after year. In reality, if you have some reduction in supply, that could explain why the price level of that year will end up being higher. But if the supply is not falling further in the next year, if supply stabilizes at a lower level, there's nothing to explain why prices would rise in the second year. You can't use that one supply reduction to explain why prices then rise in the following year. If they do rise in the following year, it's because of more demand. Now also, when there are supply crises, what usually happens? What happens almost always when there's some crisis of supply with respect to a good?
Demand goes up.
The prices go up. Well, the price rises, that's true. But then what happens?
It'll stabilize at some point.
Well, the situation should stabilize, but normally, after a crisis has occurred, typically the crisis is solved. Something occurs which offsets it. Now, if the situation were simply, we have a crisis, and then the situation is solved. If the only thing present were the crisis, what should we expect to happen after it's solved? The prices should come back down. That should be undone. But usually, when the crisis is solved, you read about that on page 57 of the paper. You read about the crisis on page 1, and people aren't as aware of the crisis being solved. They've only been aware of the crisis. And the reality is, old crises are almost always being solved. There are new crises occurring. But if we have new crises occurring, and they're matched by the solution of comparable older crises, should crises be having any effect on the price level? No, it should be a wash. And there's always something bad going on somewhere. But if last year's bad news is being solved this year, or the year before's bad news is being solved, it should not be something that is able to continually raise prices. In order for crises to, in fact, raise prices from year to year, what would need to be happening?
Supply of money and demand must be.
Well, no, if it were crises, if that were the cause.
We'd have crises all the time.
But I mean,
we'd have crises all the time.
We'd have to have more and more crises. We'd have to have a greater volume of new crises than old crises being solved. We'd have to have a continual diminution of supply. That's what it amounts to. The crisis doctrine is really attempting to blame rising prices on falling supply, and we'd have to have the supply falling year after year. Now, my watch shows we really have about 5 minutes, so I'll just go into one point here, the wage push doctrine. If it were the case that we didn't have more money in spending, and we had the unions attempting to jack up wage rates, if the unions were jacking up wage rates, what would be the effect on the number of people who could be employed? Let's say we start off, wages are initially at a level that we'll call 1. And at that level, we have full employment. Employment is 1. And we have 0 unemployment. Now we'll assume the unions jack up wage rates 10%. And they're jacking up these wage rates in the face of the same total payrolls. So we're going to have the average money wage is going to be 1.1, and that's going to equal the same demand for labor, the same total payrolls. What will have to happen to the number of workers employed at 1.1 the wage rates? How many workers can be employed at 10% higher wages with the same payroll funds? Pardon me?
10%.
Roughly 10% less. It would be the same payrolls would only employ 10/11ths the labor. If we have 11/10ths the wage, we're paying 11/10ths the wage per worker, the number of workers who could be employed would be 10/11ths, and 10/11ths is 0.91. So if we have only 0.91 workers employed, what's implied about the unemployment rate? It would go from 0 to 9%. All right, now suppose the unions keep at it, and over some further years, they've succeeded cumulatively in raising wage rates 25%. Well, if you have to pay 5/4ths the wage, 5/4ths the average wage, and you still have the same payrolls, how many workers can be employed at 5/4ths the average wage with the same total payrolls? 1/5/4 is what? 4/5. So we'd only have 80% employment. How much unemployment?
20%.
Okay. Now, in 1932 and 1933, we had a 25% unemployment rate. That's probably the worst unemployment rate we ever had. That kind of unemployment rate would result from the unions cumulatively raising wage rates in the ratio of 4/3. If the unions cumulatively jacked up wage rates to 4/3, we could only employ 3/4, or 0.75, and we then have a super depression level of 25%. Now, what do you think the unions would be doing as they're faced with a mounting level of unemployment? What did happen back in the early 80s when the unemployment rate briefly got a little over 11%?
Give backs.
Yes?
Givebacks.
The unions made major concessions. there were many unions that had contracts which called for automatic cost of living increases, and the cost of living was still increasing fairly rapidly in the early 80s. It was still going up maybe 5-6% a year, and the unions had contracts entitling them to automatic wage increases of the same amount. But had they insisted on them, what would have happened in many cases? Pardon me? There would have been firms that had to close and fire a lot of workers. And there was already a high unemployment rate, so the unions were reluctant to cause still more of their members to become unemployed. So they gave back these entitlements, came to be known as givebacks. They reduced their wage demands. Well, the implication is that long before we would get to a super depression level of unemployment, wage push would stop. You see, so long as wage push were to go on in the face of an unchanged demand for labor, each time it occurred, there'd be more unemployment. So the unions might do this up to a point, but even if we assumed it went as far as creating a super depression level of unemployment, at some point they'd stop. Now, what's implied about the maximum cumulative limit by which the unions could raise wage rates and prices before they would create a 25% unemployment rate if there were no increase in money and spending? Well, they could make wage rates higher by a cumulative total of 1/3 and make prices 1/3 higher than they otherwise might be. Now, in fact, they would probably not even succeed in raising prices at all, even though they raised wage rates, because suppose that this development is taking place over a period of years, and over the period of years in which the unions succeed in raising wage rates in the ratio of 4-3, suppose over that same period of years, improvements in technology, in capital equipment, serve to double the output per worker. So imagine we have a situation where we have only 3/4 of the workers working, but each of the workers who is working is producing on average twice as much as he used to produce. Well, what would be total output if we have 3/4 of the workers each producing on average double? What's 2 times 3/4? 2 times 3/4? 1.5. Yeah. Okay, now if you had to sell 3/2 the output for the same total money, now, what would have to happen to prices? What is the same spending divided by 3/2 the output? What's 1 divided by 3/2?
2/3.
So here we are. The unions could have wage rates 4/3, but if the productivity of labor is doubled, the prices and costs of goods would only be 2/3. The unions would not even have succeeded in driving up prices compared to what they would have been. The most they would have accomplished is to make prices higher than they would have been, but not higher than they were. If we had the same doubling of productivity without the unions raising wages, if we had the same number of workers each producing double, then we would have had twice the output, and then prices would have been halved. Well, instead of prices being halved, they only go to 2/3. Well, 2/3 is 4/3 of 1/2. 1/2 is 3/6, 2/3 is 4/6. So the unions would have made prices higher in the ratio of 4-3, but that's only in comparison to what prices would have been. Instead of being halved, prices would be 2/3. The unions would not even be able to raise prices compared to what they had been. Well, what is it that allows wage push to be a major phenomenon to go on year in and year out without burning itself out in unemployment? Pardon me? Yes? No, we've had an increase in productivity that's allowed prices to fall. I'm asking, what is it that allows the unions to keep coming back, pushing up wages higher and higher, and the process not burning itself out in mounting unemployment? By me?
Is it inflation?
Well, now what do you mean by inflation?
There's more money that's being made available.
Yeah, the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. if when the unions jack up wage rates 10%, if at the same time there's 10% more money in spending, well then is there going to be additional unemployment?
No.
No, so you don't have that pressure, and then the unions can come back and get 10% the following year. And this can go on and on indefinitely, so long as there's more money being put into the system to pump up spending, then the union demands don't result in mounting unemployment. But what happens if finally you stop the increase in money and spending or cut it down? Then unemployment develops, and this is exactly what was done in the very early 80s. The increase in money and spending had been running along at an accelerating rate from the over the 60s and 70s. But finally, in the early 80s, the Federal Reserve made a very determined effort to rein in the growth in the quantity of money and volume of spending. And at first, because wages were increasing at the old rate, the rise in wages, costs, and prices outstripped the increase in money and spending, and that resulted in a substantial increase in unemployment. But then, in the face of the higher unemployment, the demand for wage increases sharply abated. And so we were then able to stop this whole process. Wage push by itself cannot be the cause of a sustained significant rise in prices. It has to be fed by more and more money. So to whatever extent it's ever operative, it's a manifestation of the influence of more money in spending. Okay, we're about 5 or 6 minutes past our usual break time by that clock, so let's return in 25 minutes, roughly about 10 after. So I'll see you then.